Okay. All right, Parsha told us, Tafshin Ayin. So there are times that we've spent the class trying to explain small words, little words. We've talked about words like Echad, Kol, Zen, Zos, remember that? All different words. Oz, we spent time on. Well, today we're going to talk about the word Ruts. Two letters, Ruts, to run. Okay? We're going to look into the first Rashi, analyze carefully the first Rashi about, not the first Rashi, I'm sorry, that famous Rashi on this Yisrotzitzu Habanim, and try to come to a philosophical idea that Rashi is telling us without obviously speaking in essay form, right? Without describing it in full detail. So we know that Rivka became pregnant, and Pasuk Chaf Beis of Parshas told us, which is the Pasuk we're going to focus on, Yisrotzitzu Habanim Bekirba. So the children were making a lot of commotion within her, right? Vatomer, and it got to the point that she said, Im Kain, if this is the case, Lama ze anochi, why is this me? Which is a very strange formulation. She wasn't saying, why am I in so much pain? She said, Lama ze, why is this anochi? Very strange, right? Very awkward. Vatilech, v'telech, lidros es Hashem, and she went to seek out some type of clarity, some type of way of approaching this issue. Now, she didn't go to a doctor because she was having a lot of, pain. She obviously was going through more than physical turmoil. She was going through some type of spiritual turmoil. So Rashi tells you what was happening, and she realized something's very odd here. Something's not right, and it scared her. And she'd scared her to the point that she said, why is there even a concept, of the Anochi? Is there an Anochi? Lama Zeh, why is this associated with Anochi? In other words, the concept Anochi, without going into that part of the Pasuk, the Anochi is the one, the truth. And this seemed to be in contradiction to that concept that what her whole life was dedicated to would be to promote, to contribute something that would add to the Anochi, and this seemed not to be in line with that. She realized something was off. Now, what was off? So Rashi tells you this. Yisrotzitzu, and you all know this Rashi, right? You should know this very, very well. Where are we? Yisrotzitzu. Yisrotzitzu. Al karcha hamikra hazeh omer darsheni. You have no choice. This pasuk is begging for explanation. It's written in a way that demands some type of deeper analysis. It can't be read in this simple pshat. So we're looking into what the inner meaning of this is, and Rashi says, Mahi ritzitza zu. What is this ritzitza? What is this, struggling? And to the fact that she had caused her to say, Lama ze anochi, Rabbeinu darshu, rabbis were doresh. They explain this in terms of its metaphysical and its philosophical implications. Lashon ritza. Now listen very carefully, because we often lose sight of the minor nuances because the larger, obvious differences jump out at us. So it's lashon ritza. It's the lashon of ritza, of running. This whole thing means there was a running going on inside of her. So what does that mean? Kishahaiso veris al pischei Torah al shel shem ve'ever Yaakov ruts umefareches latzeis. When she would pass by a base medrash or a place of Torah, so Yaakov, they already have whole personalities and whole individualities in the womb. He would be running umefareches and jostling latzeis, trying to get out. Okay, and she would pass by overis al pischei avodah zara. So she passed by some place which was, dedicated to Avodah Zarah. Esav mifareches latzeis. Esav would jostle also to get out. So she said, what is going on? And from here, the Chazal go into this. She thought there's one child who was lurching in two directions. So what would become of the Anochi, the one, Anochi Hashem Elokecha? But let's focus on the details. What's the difference between Yaakov and Esav? So the obvious is, Yaakov was drawn to the places of Torah worship. Esav was drawn to Avodah Zarah, but Rashi's very meduyuk. He's very careful. He says, Vayisrotzitzu is Lashon Ritza. Does it use the word rutz in reference to both Yaakov and Esav? Yes or no? No, it doesn't. It says, when they pass the place of Torah, Yaakov rutz umifareches. When they pass the place of Avodah Zarah, Esav is mifareches. He's trying, he's jostling. And it doesn't use the word rutz in relationship to Esav. That's critical. Because only Yaakov is associated with the word rutz. This is the yesod. This is the basic principle of today. What does rutz mean? That Rashi is very meticulous here. It says, Vayisrotzitzu is rutz. But then it only says that Yaakov is really rutz. Esav is just jostling around inside. Now, what's the difference between agitating and moving around, which a fetus can do, and rutz, which a fetus can't do? Can a fetus run? No, of course not. But a fetus can move around, can be mifareches. That's natural for a fetus. But it's not natural to rutz. So Rashi's saying that Yaakov was running in the womb. What does that mean? Obviously, not just the pasuk says darsheni. The Rashi says darsheni. Explain me, right? So we have to work with the word rutz. And we're going to ask a prior question. If this difference is already evident in the womb, okay, that's what Rashi said. Chazal are telling us, Rashi's bringing down Chazal. They're trying to tell us that we're looking way back to their core, to their origin to see a difference. And the essential difference between them is that one can rutz and one doesn't rutz. One runs and one doesn't run. Okay, now, Rav Huttner in Purim, in Maimer Vav, in Zion, and the last Maimer in Purim goes into a fundamental idea, profound idea. He says, how do you key in to the essential, critical difference between two things? Look, if I ask you, what's the difference between an apple and an orange, it's hard to answer the question, because they're not the same at all, so obviously they're just totally different. So the difference is self-evident. How do you key into the difference of something? How do you put your finger on the difference of something, the core difference of something? If superficially they're different, then the superficial difference is so self-evident you can't even get to the core difference. Or you don't even need to look at the core difference. You don't need to analyze the DNA of an apple seed versus an orange seed to see their difference because the difference is evident. But let's say you want to choose, let's say, a car of a certain price range. So you take a GM car, right, and you take, let's say, a Honda car in the same class, same size, same price range, same, you know, with the same package of what's it called? Options. And then you try to see what's the difference between them. Maybe one has a faster engine. You know, what is the difference? So you try to eliminate the superficial differences so you can get to the core differences, right? So what we're saying here is that actually trying to decipher the difference between something becomes easier the more they're superficially the same. So when you have, for example, twins, like I have two identical twin sisters, and physically they're the same, and then you see that in personality they're different, so you begin to be able to key into the core difference and the root neshama difference of the person, because not in how they look, or the color of their hair, or anything, or their height, or anything genetic, or the way their teeth grow in, it's all the same. What's different is how they respond to certain situations. They'll respond differently. Then you get to begin to see the neshama difference, the core difference in the person, the real difference in the person. So actually, what you're saying is, it's kind of paradoxical. The more you create a situation where the exteriors are similar, the more you can actually focus on the dissimilarity. Okay? Something very strange goes on between Yaakov and Esav, and then the descendants of Esav, and us. It's not just that you can analyze and see the difference because there's similarities. There's also, what seems to be happening is, there's an attempt to create similarity between them. There's an attempt to do the same thing for both of them, to give them the same external situation. to put them in the same place at the same time. And then because of that and because of their response to that, pull out the difference. So you see, for example, that Yitzchak, first of all, you see that they're twins. They're in the womb at the same time. Okay? Now it's true that, they look different. Esav is redder and hairier. This is true. So superficially, they're not exactly the same, it seems. But it says, Vayigdalu hana'arim, the two boys grew up. Then you see personality differences. One is a Yodeya Tzayid. One is a hunter. And one is Ishtam. But obviously, if these superficial differences are obvious, they're not the core difference. The fact that one is asoy, done, like a grown man, and one is redder and hairier, and one is more, you know, maybe smoother, and the fact that one hunts and one is an intellectual, these are not the differences. These are obvious. These could blend. These could be either or. As you see later on, it had to be, as we well know, that Yaakov had to take on some of Esav's physical qualities, right? We've spoken about this. He, not just the way he looked, but his, what he was responsible for. Remember, you all know this, which we're not going into. They're both supposed to team up together to be Klal Yisrael. One the intellectual, the academic, the philosopher, one the Ish of Maisa, of deeds. Eventually Yaakov took both. So the fact that Esav was Asiya and Yaakov was the intellectual is not really what made them different. In the end, Yaakov did both, right? That wasn't their difference. One person could incorporate both. There's a much more of a core difference. So what happens here is that Yitzchak wants to give the bracha to Esav, and he tells Esav, he gives him a command, and he gives him a mitzvah to kibud av ve'em, which he knew that Esav excelled in, right? And Esav used to dress up in his best clothing, which was that she got from Nimrod, which went back to, remember this, back to the Gan Eden, back to Adam, to serve his father. And here comes Rivka, dresses Yaakov up like Esav by putting the sheepskin on him, right? Then she says, Shema Bikoli, listen to my voice and go give him the food. And my grandfather, Schwab, points out, why did she tell Yaakov Shema Bikoli? Why did it have to come about this way? Esav wanted to give, Yitzchak wanted to give Esav a bracha. Okay? In the end, that was the bracha that Yaakov got. So in that act of giving the bracha, it's the superficially, Yitzchak didn't know, supposedly, right, or in a certain level, didn't want to know, or made it that, superficially, this wasn't sure which person was standing in front of them, Yaakov or Esav. So that superficially there's a similarity, both standing before Yitzchak, both, in a, you know, Yaakov dressed up as Esav, both capable of receiving a bracha, and then the diversion, that's where it, everything diverges. Rivka makes sure that the bracha goes to Yaakov. The one zuchus, my grandfather points out, that Esav had, that made him roi to perhaps get the bracha and perhaps really fooled Yitzchak in a way to thinking that he could be a partner with Yaakov, that he could be a helpmate to Yaakov, that together they could create Klal Yisrael. So he did have one mitzvah, one zuchus, which was so overpowering that it made his whole personality seem as if it was tahar. And what was that one zuchus that Esav had? Kibud av ve'em. Rivka had to compete with that to create an equal and opposite zuchus on the same level. So she said to Yaakov, Shema Bikoli, against your will, against what you want, it's not your nature, just like it wasn't Esav's nature to be a tzaddik. It wasn't his choice, but in this area he was, in Kibud av ve'em. So Rivka made Yaakov enter into that very same experience. It's not your nature to deceive, and you don't want to do this, and it doesn't define you, it's not really you at all, but in this case, you're going to do Kibud av ve'em also as like a single, isolated mitzvah. So here they're almost spiritually at that moment in the same place, both being mechaved their parents, which is out of nature to what they really are. Not that Yaakov wasn't a tzaddik and wasn't always mechaved his parents, but in this case of fooling Yitzchak, he was asked to be like in a bubble, in a personality, you know, take on a behavior that was not entirely not his. Same with Esav, same with Yitzchak, the way he fooled, same with Esav, the way he fooled Yitzchak. Go in there looking like Yaakov and Esav. Then at that point, the bracha goes to Yaakov, and Vagam Baruch Yi, and he's the one that gets the bracha. So it's not just that, in order to see the difference between two people that at their core are different, you need to eliminate. I'm sorry, you need to, it's best if you actually have a lot of superficial similarities, as we said, like two twins, two identical twins, so you can see the difference. It's more than that. Here, Yitzchak and Rivka are creating similarity in the situation of who gets the bracha. You see that? They're creating a situation where you don't know if it's Yaakov or Esav, and then the bracha goes to the one that is deserving and worthy and ra'oi for the bracha. Now, why is this all important? Because it was not till that point where they were in their 60s that it became clear that the bracha goes to Yaakov, that Yaakov deserves it, that Yaakov can carry it, and it becomes self-evident that it's only Yaakov at this point. Because we've created, as we said, total similarity on the surface, but the core difference is who's ra'oi, who's really worthy. But now this Rashi that we started with, Vayisrotzitzu Habanim, is telling you that if everything is similar on the outside and you want to know the core difference is there from the Shoresh, from their Neshama. The core difference can be viewed already in way back in the womb. And you want to define the core difference of Yaakov and Esav? Now, stop for a second. Do you really think that when they passed Nevodah Zarah, Esav started fighting to get out? And when they passed a base medrash, Yaakov was fighting to get out? Do you really think they're predetermined in the womb to be righteous and wicked? Of course not. What we're saying is, we're saying that the Chazal are trying to tell you by giving you that Yaakov was running. He wasn't running. You can't run in a womb. They're trying to tell you that at the early, that the difference between them is at the core, which later would be expressed through their life choices, which we still hold each one as responsible for. And so we're creating a sense that they're in one womb. They can go, they have the possibility, each one, of being completely linked to each other. And yet they will, their paths will totally diverge and go into completely different directions. And the more you eliminate, the more you see the more you don't focus on superficial similarities, you get to see the differences. Now, what's the core difference? They're really trying to tell us who's Yaakov and who's the Jewish people, what defines a Jewish people, and who is everybody else, especially Esav. That's really what they're trying to say here. What led to the point that Yaakov got the bracha and Esav gave it up when he gave up the bechorah? That he had no desire for the role that Yaakov would play. What's at the core? So they bring the entire thing down. You want to know the core difference between us, who's Klal Yisrael, and why the Goyim are not, when they could have been? What was the difference? What was the core, you know, Shoresh? It's in the word Ratz. We run, and they don't run. What does that mean? By the way, when you do a Hadron, right, we're running to the base Medrash, we're running, right? We are Ratz. What does Ratz mean? So, Ratz, first of all, is the shoresh of the word ratzon. Ratzon, okay. So clearly on a superficial level, when a person desires something very much, they run after it, either physically or emotionally or psychologically, or they put in the effort, they're running, they're pursuing it. Ratz and ratzon go together, but it's much deeper than that, okay? When we talk about the concept of ratz, or Moshe Shapira discusses this, to run, to be in a hurry, we see that that concept applies to the Jewish people in interesting situations. When is the classic example of when we're in a big hurry?
Mitzrayim,
right? That there was no time for the dough to rise, and they had a rush, right? There was a great rush. So we talk about the concept of rushing. And we link it to the concept of lemala min hazman. Now, it's not so simple at first glance to understand that relationship. Lemala min hazman means it's beyond time. When a person runs, they want to beat the clock on a superficial level. They want to get there faster. It's associated with the midah of zrizus, going quickly. Okay? What's chametz? There was no time for the bread to rise and become chametz, so it became matzah, right? So, zrizim makdimim lemitzvahs, a mitzvah haba liyadcha al tach mitzen. If a mitzvah comes to your hands to do it, you have an opportunity, don't let it be lost in the dragging on of time, do it right away. So we're linking a few concepts together. Running, Zrizus, Lamala min hazman, beyond time, which is a fundamental principle. What does that all mean? Running quickly to accomplish something, running for something, is an indication of a philosophical idea called above and beyond time. Now, what does that mean? Of course, you can't run faster than time. Of course, you can't, you know, you can't be beyond the limitations of time. We live in time, obviously. In fact, many mitzvahs are time-bound. So when we say lemala min hazman, what do we really mean? We can't supersede time. If just to trigger a memory, just a little, you know, little caveat here, just remember, I don't know, some of you might remember, we spoke about when the Jewish people were born, the Bnei Yaakov, eventually Bnei Yisrael were born, they were born in a moment that was not in time. Remember Chatzos? Remember that idea about Chatzos? Chatzos, which is the time of Gilui Shechina of Yetzias Mitzrayim. We said if there's 12 hours, and 6 hours are prior to Chatzos, and 6 hours are after Chatzos, where is Chatzos, right? If you can count a full half of the night prior to Chatzos and a full half of the night after Chatzos, where is Chatzos? We said, well, let's say it's from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., so everyone says, well, Chatzos is at 12. Okay, but that second called 12 o'clock, that 1 second called 12 before it's 12:01, is divisible in half, isn't it? And each part falls on either side of the night. In fact, that second called 12 is divisible a gazillion times, no? And half of them fall on one half of the night and the other half. So there is no such thing as chatzos. It's lemala min hazman. But what we really mean to say when we say lemala min hazman is not something mystical and magical other than that moment of chatzos. What we're trying to say is that Klal Yisrael are a nation, this is our essential difference, that sees ourselves as not a product of the current, the rushing current of the time that we're living in and the forces at play in the time that we're living in. We are not a product of, we don't have to be, we want to extricate ourselves and not be a product of the time, the milieu, what's current, what everyone is almost naturally, you know, thinking like and acting like, because that's the energy of the time that we're in. Every generation, every person is born into a particular time period with different forces at play. And if a person just absorbs all those forces, becomes part of them, responds to them in their various ways, then they're a product, a victim of cause and effect. Another way to say it, sequence. Sequence, cause and effect. I'm living now. These are the forces at play. They drag me along. They catch me up. I apply my own creative, contribution, but I'm still within the forces. For example, some will tell you, and I'm not analyzing it, there was a time of nationalism. Lots of movements began when there was a time of nationalism, including Zionism as a national movement. Sometimes there are movements and all kinds of expressions are created for that movement. But they're still just products of the time. That was what was current at the time. So what happens is that it is the strongest force driving societies is the time. Right? The movement of the time. When we say we're lemala min hazman, what we're saying is that we are trying to live in which every moment where a person makes a choice, it is not because they're just responding to the forces at play at that time in their life, in their family's life, in their community's life, in their society's life, in the life of the world at that time. But that moment is in a bubble, completely disconnected from the time, and they make a choice in terms of their behavior or their life's, you know, or the steps they're going to take in their life, not because of any consideration other than something that is totally disconnected from time and place. And what is that? The Hashem's will. Right. The revealed Chachma of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not at all associated with anything else but that. They've completely extricated themselves in a bubble. They're now lemala min hazman, and from that place, they make choices. You see, when we say ratzon, will, it's not, and we've spoken about it in different contexts, so hopefully this will be familiar to you. We've talked about it in a whole different way. If a person is responding to a force, whether within themselves or from society or community or family around them, can they be said to be making a choice or to even have a rutzon, a will, to run after something? Are they choosing to pursue something? Or are they just carried along? Or they just mukhrach? The opposite of rutzon is mukhrach, hechrech, compelled. If a person eats, they are not choosing to eat. Their body forces them to eat. It's not a choice. It's not a rutzon to eat. You can't say you desire to make a choice about something which you're compelled to do because you can't overcome it because it's stronger than you. So when a person follows any of the driving forces or impulses or instincts of their body or their emotions, which are linked to their body, and here we go back to our fundamental principle of the brain, right? We said that there's three brains, just to review this aspect of it, three brains co-working in a person, the triune brain theory, and we said that, don't make a mistake, the basic brain that governs survival, which is called the what? The reptilian brain. Remember the Nachash? The reptilian brain. This is the base of the brain stem and the cerebellum. This is the brain, the oldest brain, the most primitive brain. It's called the reptilian brain because it's found in reptiles as the only part of the brain they have. We have more other parts too. So do mammals. But this brain, make no mistake about it, it drives a person. It's the force for survival. It tells you to eat when you're hungry. It sends the messages to your brain that you have to eat. It's the brain that controls the reaction to fear, flight or fright, right? It's the brain that controls, for example, the peristalsis in your intestines, the respiratory rate in your lungs, the rate of your heartbeat. It controls what your kidneys do, cleaning out your blood. It controls your liver. It controls it creates red blood cells in your spleen. It's the brain that tells your body how to survive. And make no mistake about it, it demands that you survive. It will make you eat grass and it will make you eat mud. It will put you to sleep even if you're driving. It forces you. It's a master. It's a master. It's the brain that drives a person. And it wants to survive, and its only instinct is survival. It doesn't care about any abstract theories at all. It doesn't give a hoot about the concept of kosher or Yom Kippur or that its tumas and maisers haven't been taken. It just wants to eat. This is the reptilian brain. But we're not going to spend too much time on this because we've talked about this a lot in the past. What we're saying is when a person responds to the needs of the body and its impulses, and the emotions are very often caught up in that, that is not called having a rutzon, making a choice. Rutzon is choosing something that is not compelled. If it's compelled, it's not choosing. You don't use the same word choosing to relate to things that you're compelled to do and you're going to do anyway, even if you don't choose them. That's not choice. They're two different categories. Rutzon is when you choose to ignore what's compelling you and you run after, you pursue a different way of behaving, or you make a choice not to respond, and then you can say that the person actually made a choice. Nothing else is a choice. We spoke about this in terms of tshuva, back in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, I think a year or two ago, right? We said that people can only choose to do good, to listen to Hashem, to follow the Torah. Everything else is not called making a choice. Everything else is abdicating, just completely abdicating the responsibility to choose, because everything else is just following the impulses and the drives that come from our brain and our emotional brain, the limbic system, that force us to behave and to comply to its will. It's not choice. If we're going to do it anyway because it's such a driving force in us and we can't get beyond it, then you don't say you chose it. Right? So there's only one thing. There's only one thing that distinguishes a chooser from someone who's just refusing and giving up the choice totally and just going with the flow. And that is that person has rutzon, a desire, and it's not a product of what they're compelled to do. That is a definition of rutzon. Never will we use the word rutzon and mix it up with and apply it to things that we're going to be compelled to do anyway. Okay? Because we're not stronger than those forces. So, and that could apply also to Yetzer Hara. If we're not stronger than a particular Yetzer Hara, then doing that, then succumbing to that is no choice at all. It's not a choice. It's muchrach. It has to happen. So, ratzon indicates, the concept ratzon indicates an ability to extricate oneself from all the forces playing on the person and truly choose something, you know, that is a product of, that is a product of the intellect of the person, the knowledge of the person, the commitment to the MS of the person, and nothing else. That's a definition of rutz, of rutzo. So they want to tell you that if you're looking for the difference between Yaakov and Esav, between Klal Yisrael, and who was no longer Ra'oi later on to be Klal Yisrael, the difference is at the core, but it's not going to be visible for a very long time. Eventually, Rivka and Yitzchak are going to set up a situation where it's the same. They look the same. They're in the same position, coming with the same zchuyos, but they're different. And the bracha Rivka says, and she doesn't explain. Rivka never explains. This is really the reason why Chazal go back into this original Rashi. Rivka doesn't say why she wanted Yaakov to get the bracha and not Esav. She does, it does not describe in the Torah what was her thinking, because he's Ra'oi and Esav's not Ra'oi. Doesn't tell you a word. So if you just read Torah superficially, she favored Yaakov. She was a bad mother. Whatever. I mean, that's all it is. So Chazal want to tell you that she created a situation, Yitzchak and her created a situation almost out of their own, it was a little bit out of their own hands, in which there was utter similarity at the moment of the giving of the bracha. But Rivka understood that the bracha had to go to Yaakov because at their core they were different. And if you want to know what the core difference is, you have to go back. And it's embedded in that Rashi of Ayitzrotzitzu, that there was a rutzon with Yaakov, and there wasn't a rutzon with Esav. Because nobody's running, as we said, in the womb. So the fact is that Yaakov, the Jewish people, Klal Yisrael, have survived because we have been able to extricate ourselves, to raise above the currents of the time, the milieu, and choose based on other qualifications, other priorities. That's called being lamala min hazman, above and beyond time, not subject to the forces of time. That's the core of rutzo. Now, notice this. This pattern follows through. When does Esav run? There is a point where Esav runs. It's a little bit further. Yeah. Where does Esav run? Remember? Esav does run once. And that word is important. Perek Lamed Gimel and Vayishlach. Skip ahead. What is this? Here, Yaakov took the brachas, right? Rivka made him take the brachas because he was the rutz. He was the runner. He was the rutzon. He had bechira. They went their separate ways. Because of that, he had to run away. They didn't see each other in many years. Yaakov went down to Lavan, built up his family. But then there's a reunion. They're coming back together. And Esav and Yaakov here, they meet each other. And here, Esav rethinks his life choice of selling the Bechora, of abdicating this entire responsibility, and he actually makes an offer to join up with Yaakov here, and join the Yaakov's lot. So we're look at Perek Lamed Gimel Pasuk Dalet. This is when Yaakov and Esav meet for the first time after this separation, which came from the bracha incident. Vayaratz Esav lekraso, and Esav did run to greet Yaakov. Here's a Hero Tshuva. He saw Yaakov was destined to, although it had to go through the path of Gullus, and he asked Yaakov to join him. Right? And it would go through a difficult path, but Yaakov was going somewhere. He was going somewhere, and Esav was being left behind because he himself didn't want to be a rutz. He himself didn't have the rutz zone to extricate himself. That was the difference. The difference wasn't that one was a hunter and one was a scholar. In the end, Yaakov was a hunter and a scholar. The difference wasn't that one was complete at birth and one was still working on himself. This wasn't the difference. The difference was in their core desire. So here, Esav has a hirachuva. Vayaros Esav lekraso, v'yechabkeo, and he hugs him. And look at this, Vayipal al tzavarav, and he fell on his neck. Do you know what the tzavarav always represents? When Yaakov and Yosef cried on their necks? The batei mikdash that Esav would destroy. Yaakov and Yosef cried on each other's necks on the Chorban. Chazal say they were also in the Chorban of the batei mikdash. It's the imagery, the muscle of the neck is the Beis HaMikdash, without getting into it now. He falls on his neck. He sees where their different paths will take them. Yaakov will build the Beis HaMikdash, and Esav, because of the inability to appreciate and to be partners with Yaakov, will ultimately destroy that Beis HaMikdash out of jealousy. It's always out of jealousy, out of a sense of guilt and regret that they could have had it and it could have been theirs and they gave it up, which is the core, by the way, the secret of when he sold his bechorah. It says he ate and he drank and he got up, vayivez, and he mocked it. You only mock something if you're feeling very guilty. Otherwise, say, fine, you do your thing, I do mine. I don't care, whatever. But if you actually have to mock somebody for what they've achieved, that comes from tremendous guilt and a sense of regret and a little bit of self-loathing that you could have had it too and you didn't, and they got it, and then you say, well, who cares, who wanted it anyway? That mockery. So here he falls on his neck, v'yishakeo, and he kisses him. Vayivchu, how many more descriptive, you know, words do you need to show that Esav here understood what was happening? They were parting ways. That's vayarutz. And they meet, and what does he offer? He offers to travel together with him. Look at Pasuk Yudbeis. Vayomer nisa, v'nelcha, let's go and walk together. V'elcha l'negdecha, and I'll go with you, opposite you, parallel to you. Let's rejoin forces. Esav had a moment here where he wanted to rejoin forces with Yaakov. But what does Yaakov answer? He's a very funny answer. You go ahead, I'm going to go slow. That's the opposite of running. Right, he says in Pasuk Yudalad, Yavar na doni lifnei avdo, you go first. Vani esnahala le'iti, I'm going slowly. As if he's telling Esav, you might say, you're not really a rutz. You say you want to run and you want to join me, but I don't really think that you're capable of it. It's not going to happen anymore. You can't. You've taken a different path. And it's not in your nature to do this. And he actually says, In this case, I'm not running with you. I'm going to go slow. You're running, you could run, but you're not going anywhere. You're not going where I'm going with you running. So Esav actually here, you see, and this, you know, understands the value of Vayarutz, of Yaakov. Interestingly enough, this whole thing of being caught up in the milieu, right? Cause and effect. Without going into it in too much detail, it shows up all the time when you learn about Purim. The whole Purim thing is that Esav, later Amalek, are like the quintessential examples of believing in cause and effect. Right? The quintessential, you know, the nation that displays a trust in cause and effect. Look at Haman. He came up with so many plans that he was sure would lead to his desired end of entrapping, you know, the Jewish people, killing Mordechai. He had so many plans. Go way back to getting rid of Vashti. He had so many plans. He worked his whole system out on cause and effect, right? He planned it all very carefully. In fact, they called him, remember, Memuchan. He was called Memuchan in the beginning of the Megillah, and he said, you know what, let's get rid of Vashti, because let's put someone else on the throne. And Chazal say there, Memuchan, he was Muchan, he was ready. He had been already deviously preparing a way to get himself on that throne, and he knew that Vashti stood in his way, because she was really of royal blood, not Nebuchadnezzar, was some powerful warlord who managed to marry her. And he knew that if he could get rid of her, he could compete with Ahasuerus. So he already had a plan and was looking for an opportunity to jump in. So when there was an opportunity arose, what should we do with Vashti? He was Muchan. He had it all set up, sequence, cause and effect. The funny thing about Haman is everything he planned, every cause he created, did not lead at all to the effect that he intended. It led to the wrong effect. He put Esther on the throne, right? He put the 10,000 shekel in there, and the king said, no, you know what, I don't want it, you keep it. In the end, who got it? Mordechai got it. Mordechai got all his money. He built the gallows. Who hung on them? He said, "This you should drive him around on your horse." Who had to drive who around on? Who had to lead who around on the horse? Everything went wrong. There was cause, but the effect came from a different place. It was a total, you know, it was a total violation of the trust in cause and effect. That's because he was up against Klal Yisrael, who are lamala min hazman, zman being the cause, the currents, the natural progression of the time and of the what we would think would lead one thing to the next. You know, where does Haman rush? Where is Haman rushed? He's lamala min hazman all of a sudden. He's extracted from his misconception of cause and effect, of zman, hazmana, preparation, where one thing leads to the next. He runs Tachashverosh with his plan, right? But where is he? When does it say that he was that he was rushed? He was taken out of his plan. They have Hilu as Haman Behola. They took him to the party. What happened at the party? That's where his downfall came. In the end, because he was competing with Klal Yisrael, his downfall came in a state of running, confusion, rushing. He was pulled out of his. For the first time, he got a glimpse then that all his plans, all his carefully laid out plans, that, you know, as we said, are part of the concept of zman, hazmana. You prepare one thing and it leads to the following result, and that leads to the next result. So that he was pulled out of that, and he got to see the whole thing worked against him. He was working with a people that don't function by cause and effect, that are not subjects to the forces of the particular time. I want to read you here from the Medrash Rabbah. With this we're going to end. It says that by Adam, Bereshis, when he sinned, Hashem had to kick him out of Gan Eden, right? It says, Va'ata, and now, with an ayin, now, pen yishlach yado, maybe he's going to reach out his hand and take from, what's the end of the pasuk? The Eitzachayim, right? So we have to remove him. Amar of Abba Bar Kahana, Melamed, Shepasach lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Pesach Shel Tshuva. At that moment, when Adam sinned, by eating from the Eitz HaDas, right? Remember Haman? Where is Haman in the Torah? Hamin ha'eitz asher amarti losochel. The sin of Haman is linked right back to the original sin of Adam of disobeying, the original sin that led to everything that's, you know, this just on Hashem's side or contrary. So we're saying that Haman, which embodies the opposite of bechira, of truth, is already linked way back. The core here is at this sin. But Hashem gave Adam an opportunity to do tshuva. Where is that indicated in the pasuk? In the word ata, and now. Ata is linked to tshuva. And now, let's take him out of Gan Eden, because we don't want to eat at Eitz HaChayim, which we're not going to talk about. But the word now proves that Hashem gave him an opportunity to tshuva. Why? Ein ata ela tshuva. Ata refers to tshuva. We never think of the word now as tshuva. So he brings a pasuk from Devarim, Perek Yud, Va'ata Yisrael, Ma Hashem Elokecha Doresh Mimcha, right? Now, using the word now. So how is Ata Tshuva? Because Ata, it's almost like an existential thought. Ata means now, this moment, disconnected from everything around it. Right now, it is irrelevant that a person's behavior defined them up till this point as a certain kind of person, a sinner, a liar, a thief, an adulterer, a cheat or a balash and hara, that whatever it is, any type of sin, that all the forces, the cause and effect, the normal, you know, the forces that work on a person, the history of a person, they all lead for a person to be defined in a certain way. But a person always has the koach of tshuva. What is tshuva? To pluck themselves out of the moment. Now, create an ata, a moment that's this moment right now, that has no connection to anything before it. It's not part of the progression. Just because a person sinned a few times doesn't mean they're condemned to follow that pattern forever. They can pull themselves out and create a bubble called ata right now. And make a choice to change their behavior, to change their pattern. And then when they re-enter, so to speak, they're walking down a different road. They're in a different pattern. We're not compelled by the past, by the cause and effect, by the currents that are pulling on us. Even our own history we're not compelled by. That's tshuva. That's bechira. Bechira and tshuva are always linked together. What Rambam puts his whole treatise of what bechira is in Hilchas Tshuva. He doesn't put it in he could have put it in any many, many sections of his massive work of the Mishnah Torah. He puts bechira in the little pamphlet of Hilchas Tshuva, the little work of Hilchas Tshuva. Because in the end, bechira is the choice, is ratzon. These are all ideas that are linked together. So here's how it works. Ratz, to run. Zrizus. Lamala min azman. Bechira. These are all linked concepts. That in order to really choose, a person has to see themselves as having a ratzon that is not a product of what they're compelled to do anyway, even because they're compelled to do it, because that's their own personal history. Very often we sin because that's who we are. We've done it so many times. Who are we fooling? Who are we fooling? So we won't sin today. Big deal. We'll just fall back in the pattern tomorrow. What's the point of what's the point of limiting ourselves now or restraining ourselves now? We're not enjoying this particular indulgence now. It's not that we've utterly uprooted our personality. We're just having self-control for this one moment. What's the point? We still have a nature. We might as well just let it flow. That's why most people sin. Most people sin because they see themselves in the pattern of who they are. And they don't see themselves as a totally different person going on down a different road. So that is the core, the essence of ratzon, of bechira. That's the Jewish people. The Jewish people have always been able, this is why we're eternal. We're lamala min hazman. We are not subject to the ravages, you might say, of time. We still are youthful and energetic. Every new dar, even if they're coming right out of a Holocaust, has the youthful energy to rebuild Jewish life, to build shuls and schools and yeshivas and hospitals and get married again and have weddings and have children after everybody was, the 3 years before, wives and children and husbands. It's a certain renewal, an energy of renewal. We're not subject to the forces of time that would destroy us. We're eternal. We have an eternal force within us. And that's what Chazal are telling you. Yaakov was rutz. He was a rutz. That defines Klal Yisrael. Running. At the core, that's the difference. Anybody who has that same ambition and drive becomes Klal Yisrael. Any non-Jew, anyone who's not a child of of the Jewish people, can become a Jew. They have to have one real quality, which is ratzon, a desire to extricate themselves from the patterns that created them and are creating them, and make a different choice, respond to a different set of greater eternal true values, and extricate. The one thing that we see, interesting, is human beings have a natural desire. We are hardwired not to be just silly little victims of the currents that are rushing around us. Everybody wants to feel like they're a free thinker and they're different and they're not just a product of of society. So everybody wants to many people want to kind of express themselves differently, be rebellious, break out of the norms. But the funny thing is they just choose other currents to become enslaved to. It's not really choice. They want to break out of a particular current, a certain conformity, a certain force, a certain expectation. So they break out and they take for themselves a different road. But that road itself has its own rules and obligations and conformity. So they're not really breaking free at all. Real freedom, as we say by Har Sinai, Ein Lecha Ben Chorin. Right? Elamisha Osek Batermitzus, because now this is a very profound, and this is really the end. If you want to break out of the forces that carry us along and not end up just in another channel of the same river, another canal of the same river. There's forces, and the forces are either going this way or this way, or it's a lot of tributaries to those forces. You don't want to be in any of them. You really want to make your own choice. How is that possible? There's really only one way possible. You need outside, disconnected, objective truth. It only comes back to the Torah's truth. It can't be, you can't find it other than from a completely separated source. So that person, that's the only way to find real freedom and the ability to truly respond to something that's not just a product of people's ideas and people's will at the time. has to be completely beyond that. That's where they say by the Har Sinai, that's real chayrus, that's real freedom. Okay, so that being the case, whatever. That is hopefully we understand the word rotzon. Have a wonderful week, everybody. And Mirza Shem, we will see you next week. Oh, next week, right, I wanted to say that. How many people want to come Thanksgiving?
Oh, it's true.
Thanksgiving? What should we do? Should we have class Thanksgiving?